famous instance of what John Kerry, formerly a Vietnam Veterans Against the War, now a U.S. Senator, called, not isolated incidents, but crimes committed on a day-to-day basis with the full awareness of officers at all levels of command. Appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in April 1971, Kerry said, over 150 honorably discharged and many very highly decorated veterans testified to war crimes committed in Southeast Asia. He went on to retell how American troops had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, razed villages in fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan, shot cattle and dogs for fun, poisoned food stocks, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam. All this was, in addition to the normal ravage of war. Any photograph of an American soldier setting fire to a Vietnamese hooch, a common sight during the war, would get this point across. But no textbook uses any photograph of any wrongdoing by an American. Indeed, no book includes any photograph of any destruction, even of legitimate targets caused by our side. Only Discovering American History, an inquiry textbook, treats the My Lai massacre as anything but an isolated incident. In addition to leaving students ignorant of the history of the war, the silence of other textbooks on this matter also makes the anti-war movement incomprehensible. Two textbook authors, James West Davidson and Mark H. Little, are on record elsewhere as knowing of the importance of My Lai. The American strategy had atrocity built into it, Little said to me. Davidson and Little devote most of a chapter to the My Lai massacre in their book, After the Fact. There they tell how news of the massacre stunned the United States. One thing was certain, they write. The encounter became a defining moment in the public's perception of the war. Plainly, they do not think high school students need to know about it, however. For their high school history textbook, The United States, A History of the Republic, like seven other textbooks in my sample, never mentions My Lai. If textbooks omit all the important photographs of the Vietnam War, what images do they include? Uncontroversial shots, for the most part. Servicemen on patrol, walking through swamps or jumping from helicopters. Seven books show refugees or damage caused by the other side. But since such damage was usually less extensive than that caused by our bombardment, the pictures aren't very dramatic. What about their prose? Sadly, textbook authors also leave out all the memorable quotations of the era. Martin Luther King, Jr., the first major leader to come out against the war, opposed it in his trademark cadences. "We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have corrupted their women and their children and killed their men." No textbook quotes King. Even more famous was The Descent of Muhammad Ali, then the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. Ali refused induction into the military, for which his title was stripped from him, and said, "No Viet Cong ever called me nigger." All 12 textbooks leave out that line, too. After the Tet Offensive, a U.S. Army officer involved in retaking Ben Tre said, "It became necessary to destroy the town to save it." For millions of Americans, this statement summarized America's impact on Vietnam. No textbook supplies it. Nor does any textbook quote John Kerry's plea for immediate withdrawal. How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? Indeed, the entire anti-war movement becomes unintelligible because textbooks don't allow it to speak for itself. They exclude the anti-war songs, the chants, "Hell no, we won't go," and "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" And above all, the emotions. Virtually the only people who get quoted are Presidents Johnson and Nixon. In a typical passage in the American pageant, Nixon says, "America cannot and will not conceive all the plans, design all the programs, execute all the decisions, and undertake all the defense of the free nations of the world. The passage doesn't help to clarify the war or the opposition to it. Even Pageant's auxiliary reader quotes only Johnson and Nixon as primary sources on the Vietnam War, not a word from those who fought in or opposed it. Having excluded the sights, the sounds, and the feelings of the Vietnam era, textbook authors proceed to exclude the issues. Francis Fitzgerald, who, in addition to America Revised, wrote Fire in the Lake, a fine book about Vietnam, called the textbooks she reviewed in 1979 neither hawkish nor dovish on the war. They are simply evasive. She went on to say, since it's really quite hard to discuss the war and evade all the major issues, their Vietnam sections make remarkable reading. To some degree, defining the issues is a matter of interpretation, and I wouldn't want to fault textbooks for holding a different interpretation from my own. Perhaps we can agree that any reasonable treatment of the Vietnam War would discuss at least these six questions. Why did the United States fight in Vietnam? What was the war like before the United States entered it? How did we change it? How did the war change the United States? Why did an anti-war movement become so strong in the United States? What were its criticisms of the war in Vietnam? Were they right? Why did the United States lose the war? What lessons should we take from the experience? Simply to list these questions is to recognize that each of them is still controversial. Take the first. Some people still argue that the United States fought in Vietnam to secure access to the country's valuable natural resources. Others claim that we fought to bring democracy to Vietnam's people. Perhaps more common are analyses of our internal politics, Democratic presidents Kennedy and Johnson, having seen how Republicans castigated Truman for losing China, didn't want to be seen as losing Vietnam. Another interpretation brings forth the domino theory. While we know now that Vietnam's communists are antagonists of China, we didn't then. And some leaders believe that if Vietnam fell to the communists, so would Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Yet another view is that America felt its prestige was on the line, so it didn't want a defeat in Vietnam, lest Pax Americana be threatened in Africa, South America, or elsewhere in the world. Some conspiracy theorists go even further and claim that big business fomented the war to help the economy. Other historians take a longer view, arguing that our intervention in Vietnam derives from a cultural pattern of racism and imperialism that began with the First Indian War in Virginia in 1622, continued to the 19th century with Manifest Destiny, and is now winding down in the American century. They point out that GIs in Vietnam collected and displayed Vietnamese ears just as British colonists in North America collected and displayed Indian scalps. A final view might be that there was no clear cause and certainly no clear purpose, that we blundered into the war because no subsequent administration had the courage to undo our 1946 mistake of opposing a popular independence movement. The fundamental blunder with respect to Indochina was made after 1945, wrote Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, when our government allowed itself to be persuaded by the French and British to restore France's colonial possession in Indochina. Perhaps the seeds of America's tragic involvement with Vietnam were sown at Versailles in 1918, when Woodrow Wilson failed to hear Ho Chi Minh's plea for his country's independence. Perhaps they germinated when FDR's policy of not helping the French recolonize Southeast Asia after World War II terminated with his death. Since textbooks rarely suggest that events of one period caused events of the next, unsurprisingly, none of the textbooks I surveyed looked before the 1950s to explain the Vietnam War. Within the 1950s and 1960s, the historical evidence for some of these conflicting interpretations is much weaker than for others, although I will not choose sides here. Textbook authors need not choose sides either. They could present several interpretations, along with an overview of the historical support for each, and invite students to come to their own conclusions. Such challenges are not the textbook author's style, however. They seem compelled to present the right answer to all questions, even unresolved controversies. So, which interpretation do they choose? None of the above. Most textbooks simply dodge the issue. Here is a representative analysis from American Adventures. Later in the 1950s, war broke out in South Vietnam. This time the United States gave aid to the South Vietnamese government. War broke out. What could be simpler? Adventures devotes 4 pages to discussing why we got into the War of 1812, but just these 2 sentences to why we fought in Vietnam. One reason textbook authors tiptoe through the recent past, evading all the main issues, may be that they don't feel they have the expertise to deal with it. None of the 45 authors of the 12 textbooks in my sample is an expert on the recent past, so far as I can tell. Of course, even textbooks written by several authors necessarily treat many subjects on which their authors cannot be expert. For topics in the Zamani, however, textbook authors can use historical perspective as a shield. By writing in an omniscient, boring tone about events in the Zamani, authors imply that a single historical truth exists, upon which historians have agreed, and which they now teach, and students now should memorize. Such writing implies that historical perspective grows ever more accurate with the passage of time, blessing today's textbook authors with cumulative historical insight. They cannot use historical perspective to defend their treatment of events in the Sasha, however. Without historical perspective, textbook authors appear naked. No particular qualification gives them the right to narrate recent events with the same Olympian detachment with which they declaim on events in the Zamani. Indeed, historical perspective implicitly justifies neglecting the Sasha. Historians tell us how we are too close to whichever recent event we are discussing to be able to step back and view it in context. As new material becomes available in archives, they claim, or as the consequence of actions become clearer over time, we can reach a more objective assessment. The passage of time does not in itself provide perspective, however. Information is lost as well as gained over time. At this point, we might usefully recall a few changes in perspective noted in earlier chapters. Woodrow Wilson enjoys a dramatically more positive ranking now than in 1920. The improvement didn't derive from the discovery of fresh information on his administration, but from the ideological needs of the late 1940s and early 1950s. In those years, white historians would hardly fault Wilson for segregating the federal government, because no consensus held that racial segregation was wrong. The foremost public issue of that post-war era wasn't race relations, but the containment of communism. During the Cold War, our government operated as it did under Wilson, with semi-declared wars, executive deception of Congress, and suppression of civil liberties in the name of anti-communism. Wilson's policies, controversial and unpopular in 1920, had become ordinary by the 1950s. Statesmen and historians of the 1950s rejected and even trivialized isolationism. Interested in pushing the United Nations, then thoroughly under U.S. influence, they appreciated Wilson's efforts on behalf of the League of Nations. N. Gordon Levin Jr. put it neatly. Ultimately, in the post-World War II period, Wilsonian values would have their complete triumph in the bipartisan Cold War consensus. Thus, Wilson's improved evaluation in today's textbooks can be attributed largely to the fact that the ideological needs of the 1950s, when Wilson was in the Zamani, were different from those of the 1920s, when he was passing into the Sasha. The mistreatment and enslavement of the Caribbean Indians by the Spaniards was noted by Bartolomé de las Casas and others while Columbus was still in the Sasha. Later, however, Columbus was lionized as a daring man of science, who disproved the flat earth notion and opened a new hemisphere to progress. This 19th century Columbus appealed to a nation concluding 300 years of triumphant warfare over Indian nations. But by 1992, Columbus the Exploiter had begun receiving equal billing with Columbus the Explorer, and many Columbus celebrations drew counter-celebrations, often mounted by Native Americans. The new Columbus, closer to the Columbus of the Sasha, appealed to a nation that had to get along with dozens of former colonies, now new nations. The contrast between 1892 and 1992 celebrations of Columbus's first voyage again shows the effect of different vantage points. The Confederate myth of Reconstruction first permeated the historical literature during the nadir of race relations, from 1890 to 1920, and hung on in textbooks until the 1960s. Reconstruction regimes came to be portrayed as illegitimate and corrupt examples of Negro domination. Now historians have returned to the view of Reconstruction put forth in earlier histories, written while Republican governments still administered the Southern states. Eric Foner hails the change as due to objective scholarship and modern experience, a turn of phrase that concisely links the two key causes. Objective scholarship does exist in history, which is why I risk words like truth and lies. Mere chronological distance didn't promote a more accurate depiction of Reconstruction, because the facts about Reconstruction simply didn't suit the modern experience of the Nader period. They lay mute during the early decades of the 20th century, overlooked by most historians. Not until the civil rights movement altered modern experience could the facts speak to us. Historical perspective is thus not a byproduct of the passage of time. A more accurate view derives from Leon Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance, which suggests that the social practices of the period when history is written largely determine that history's perspective on the past. Objective scholarship must be linked with a modern experience that permits it to prevail. The claim of inadequate historical perspective will not do as an excuse for ignoring the Sasha. Historians have no reason other than timidity for avoiding a full and thoughtful exposition of our recent past. Textbook authors are not solely responsible for the slighting of the recent past in high school history courses. Even if textbooks gave the Sasha the space it deserves, most students would have to read about it on their own, because most teachers never get to the end of the textbook. In her year-long American history course, the fifth-grade teacher Chris Zajac, subject of Tracy Kidder's Among School Children, never gets past Reconstruction. Time is not the only problem. Like publishers, teachers don't want to risk offending parents. Moreover, according to Linda McNeil, most teachers particularly don't want to teach about Vietnam. Their memories of the Vietnam War era made them wish to avoid topics on which the students were likely to disagree with their views, or that would make the students cynical about American institutions. Therefore, the average teacher grants the Vietnam War 0 to 4.5 minutes in the entire school year. The Vietnam War isn't nearly as contentious as some other issues from the recent past. Today, more than 2 of 3 adult Americans consider the war to have been morally wrong as well as tactically inept. More controversial is the women's movement. Every school district includes parents who strongly affirm traditional sex roles and other parents who do not. Homosexuality is even more taboo as a subject of discussion or learning. Raising the topic of affirmative action leads to angry debates. A negative evaluation of the Carter or Reagan administrations would surely offend some Democratic or Republican parents, respectively. Mel and Norma Gobler, who organize right-wingers to pressure textbook publishers, seek to make labor unions and the National Council of Churches too controversial for authors and publishers even to mention. Since all parents have opinions about events they lived through, teachers and authors may feel they must approach most topics in the Sasha with extreme caution. The result is a history of the recent past along the line suggested by Thumper's mom. If you can't say something nice, don't say nothing at all. Surprisingly, only 2-4% of college students say they had any substantial treatment of the Vietnam War in high school. When textbooks downplay the Sasha, however, they make it hard for students to draw connections between the study of the past, their lives today, and the issues they will face in the future. Politicians across the political spectrum invoked the lessons of Vietnam as they debated intervening in Angola, Lebanon, Kuwait, Somalia, and Bosnia. Bumper stickers reading, "El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam," helped block sending U.S. troops to that nation. The lessons of Vietnam have also been used to inform or mislead discussions about secrecy, the press, how the federal government operates, and even whether the military should admit gays. Issues raised by the women's movement in the 1970s continue to reverberate through American society, affecting institutions from individual families to the mass media, and so on. High school graduates have a right to enough knowledge about the recent past to participate intelligently in such debates. "The past is never dead," wrote William Faulkner. "It's not even past. The Sasha is our most important past, because it isn't dead, but living dead. Its theft by textbooks and teachers is the most wicked crime schools perpetrate on high school students, depriving them of perspective about the issues that most affect them. The semi-remembered factoids students carry with them about the Battle of Put-in Bay or Silent Cal Coolidge do little to help them understand the world into which they move at graduation. That world is still working out sex roles. That world is full of third-world nations with potential to become new Vietnams. That world is marked by social inequality. Leaving out the recent past ensures that students will take away little from their history courses that they can apply to that world." Florida's Disney World presents an exhibit called American Adventure, a 29-minute history of the United States. The exhibit completely leaves out the Vietnam War, the ghetto riots of the 1960s and 1990s, and anything else troubling about the recent past. The compressed and bland accounts of the recent past in American history textbooks show a similar failure of nerve on the part of authors, publishers, and many teachers. High school students deserve better than Disney World history, especially since their textbooks are by no means as much fun as the amusement park. Chapter 10. Progress is our most important product. God has not been preparing the English-speaking and Teutonic peoples for 1,000 years for nothing. He has given us the spirit of progress to overwhelm the forces of reaction throughout the earth. He has made us adept in government that we may administer government among savage and senile peoples. And of all our race, he has marked the American people as his chosen nation to finally lead in the redemption of the world. Senator Albert J. Beveridge, 1900. Americans see history as a straight line and themselves standing at the cutting edge of it as representatives for all mankind. Francis Fitzgerald. The study of economic growth is too serious to be left to the economists. E. J. Michon. It is becoming increasingly apparent that we shall not have the benefits of this world for much longer. The imminent and expected destruction of the life cycle of the world ecology can only be prevented by a radical shift in outlook from our present naive conception of this world as a testing ground to a more mature view of the universe as a comprehensive matrix of life forms. Making this shift in viewpoint is essentially religious, not economic or political. Vine Deloria, Jr. Steadfast reader, we are about to do something no high school American history class has ever accomplished in the annals of American education. Reach the end of the textbook. What final words do American history courses impart to their students? The American tradition assures students that the American tradition remains strong enough to meet the many challenges that lie ahead. if these values are those on which most Americans can agree, says The American Adventure. The American Adventure will surely continue. Most Americans remained optimistic about the nation's future. They were convinced that their free institutions, their great natural wealth, and the genius of the American people would enable the U.S. to continue to be, as it always has been, the land of promise. Land of Promise concludes. Even textbooks that don't end with their titles close with the same vapid cheer. The American spirit surged with vitality as the nation headed toward the close of the 20th century. The authors of The American Pageant assure us, ignoring opinion polls that suggest the opposite. Life and liberty climbs further out on this hollow limb. America will have a great role to play in these future events. What this nation does depends on the people in it. Problems lie ahead, certainly, predicts American Adventures, but so do opportunities. The American people need only the will and the commitment to meet the new challenges of the future, according to Triumph of the American Nation. In short, all we must do to prepare for the morrow is keep our collective chin up. As usual, such content-free unanimity signals that a social archetype lurks nearby. This one, the archetype of progress, bursts forth in full flower on the textbook's last pages, but has been germinating from their opening chapters. For centuries, Americans viewed their own history as a demonstration of the idea of progress. As Thomas Jefferson put it, "Let the philosophical observer commence a journey from the savages of the Rocky Mountains eastward towards our seacoast." These he would observe in the earliest stage of association, living under no law but that of nature. He would next find those on our frontiers in the pastoral state, raising domestic animals to supply the defects of hunting. And so, in his progress, he would meet the gradual shades of improving man until he would reach his, as yet, most improved state in our seaport towns. This, in fact, is equivalent to a survey, in time, of the progress of man from the infancy of creation to the present day. And where this progress will stop, no one can say. The idea of progress dominated American culture in the 19th century, and was still being celebrated in Chicago at the Century of Progress Exposition in 1933. As recently as the 1950s, more was still assumed to be better. Every Midwestern town displayed civic pride and signs marking the city limits. Welcome to Decatur, Illinois. Population 65,000 and growing. Growth meant progress, and progress provided meaning, in some basic but unthinking way. In Washington, the Secretary of Commerce routinely celebrated when our nation hit each new milestone. 170 million, 185 million, etc., on his population clock. We boasted that America's marvelous economic system had given the United States 72% of the world's automobiles, 61% of the world's telephones, and 92% of the world's bathtubs. And all this with only 6% of the world's population. The future looked brighter yet. Most Americans believed their children would inherit a better planet and enjoy fuller lives. This is the America in which most textbook authors grew up, and the America they still try to sell to students today. Three textbooks offer appendices that trace recent trends, all onwards and upwards. These efforts are undistinguished. They don't use constant dollars, for one thing, so their bar graphs of rapidly rising family income or healthcare expenditures show far more progress if spending more on healthcare is progress, than occurred. The American pageant records the steep increase, flattening in about 1980, in the number of automobiles in the United States, percentage of American homes with television sets, and the like. No textbook charts phenomena that might be negative, such as frequency of air pollution alerts, increased reliance on imported oil, or declining real wages. Perhaps textbook's authors don't question the notion that bigger is better, because the idea of progress conforms with the way Americans like to think about education. Ameliorative, leading step by step to opportunity for individuals and progress for the whole society. The ideology of progress also provides hope for the future. Certainly, most Americans want to believe that their society has been, on balance, a boon, and not a curse to mankind and to the planet. History textbooks go even further to imply that simply by participating in society, Americans contribute to a nation that is constantly progressing and remains the hope of the world. The closing sentence of The American Pageant states, "As the 20th century approaches its sunset, the people of the United States can still proudly claim in the words of Lincoln that they and their heritage represent the last best hope of Earth." Thus, the idea of American exceptionalism, the United States as the most moral country in the world, which starts in our textbooks with the Pilgrims, gets projected into the future. Faith in progress has played various functions in society and in American history textbooks. The faith has promoted the status quo in the most literal sense, for it proclaims that to progress, we must simply do more of the same. This belief has been particularly useful to the upper class, because Americans could be persuaded to ignore the injustice of social class if they thought the economic pie kept getting bigger for all. The idea of progress also fits with social Darwinism, which implies that the lower class is lower owing to its own fault. Progress as an ideology has been intrinsically anti-revolutionary, because things are getting better all the time, everyone should believe in the system. Portraying America so optimistically also helps textbooks withstand attacks by ultra-patriotic critics in Texas and other textbook adoption states. Internationally, referring to have-not countries as developing nations has helped the developed nations avoid facing the injustice of worldwide stratification. In reality, development has been making third-world nations poorer compared to the first world. Per capita income in the first world was 5 times that in the third world in 1850, 10 times in 1960, and 14 times by 1970. The vocabulary of progress remains relentlessly hopeful, however, with regard to undeveloped. As E.J. Michan put it, "Complacency is suffused over the globe. By referring to these destitute and sometimes desperate countries by the fatuous nomenclature of developing nations." In the 19th century, progress provided an equally splendid rationale for imperialism. Europeans and Americans saw themselves as performing governmental services for and utilizing the natural resources of natives in distant lands, who were too backward to do it themselves. Gradually, the archetype of progress has been losing its grip. In the last quarter century, the intellectual community in the United States has largely abandoned the idea. Opinion polls show that the general public, too, has been losing its faith that the future is automatically getting better. Reporting this new climate of opinion, the editors of a 1982 symposium entitled "Progress and Its Discontents" put it this way. Future historians will probably record that from the mid-20th century on, it was difficult for anyone to retain faith in the idea of inevitable and continuing progress. Probably not even textbook authors still believe that bigger is necessarily better. No one celebrates higher populations. Today, rather than boast of our consumption, we are more likely to lament our waste, as in this passage by Donella H. Meadows, co-author of The Limits to Growth. "In terms of spoiling the environment and using world resources, we are the world's most irresponsible and dangerous citizens. Each American born in the 1970s will throw out 10,000 no-return bottles and almost 20,000 cans while generating 126 tons of garbage and 9.8 tons of particulate air pollution. And that's just the tip of the trashberg, because every ton of waste at the consumer end has also required 5 tons at the manufacturing stage and even more at the site of initial resource extraction. In some ways, bigger still seems to equal better. When we compare ourselves to others around us, having more seems to bring happiness, for earning a lot of money or driving an expensive car implies that one is a more valued member of society. Sociologists routinely find positive correlations between income and happiness. Over time, however, and in an absolute sense, more may not mean happier. Americans believed themselves to be less happy in 1970 than in 1957, yet they used much more energy and raw materials per capita in 1970. The 1973 Arab oil embargo precipitated the new climate of opinion, for it showed America's vulnerability to economic and even geological factors over which we have little control. The new pessimism was exemplified by the enormous popularity of that year's ecocidal bestseller, The Limits to Growth. Writing the next year, Robert Heilbronner noted the new pessimism. "There is a question in the air. Is there hope for man?" Robert Nisbet, who thinks that the idea of progress has done more good over a 2,500-year period than any other single idea in Western history, nonetheless agrees that the idea is in twilight. This change didn't take place all at once. Intellectuals had been challenging the idea of progress for some time, dating back to The Decline of the West, published during World War I, in which Oswald Spengler suggested that Western civilization was beginning a profound and inevitable downturn. The war itself, the Great Depression, Stalinism, the Holocaust, and World War II shook Western belief in progress at its foundations. Developments in social theory further undermined the idea of progress by making social Darwinism intellectually obsolete. Modern anthropologists no longer believed that our society is ahead of, or fitter than, so-called primitive societies. They realize that our society is more complex than its predecessors, but don't rank our religions higher than primitive religions, or consider our kinship system superior. Even our technology, though assuredly more advanced, may not be better in that it may not meet human needs over the long term. Another key justification for our belief in progress had come from biological theory. Biologists used to see natural evolution as the survival of the fittest. By 1973, a much more complex view of the development of organisms had swept the field. Life is not a tale of progress, according to Stephen Jay Gould. It is, rather, a story of intricate branching and wandering, with momentary survivors adapting to changing local environments, not approaching cosmic or engineering perfection. Since textbooks don't discuss ideas, it's no surprise that they fail to address the changes in American thinking resulting from World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, or Stalinism, let alone from developments in anthropological or biological theory. By 1973, however, another problem with progress was becoming apparent: the downside risks of our increasing dominance over nature. Environmental problems have grown more ominous every year. Most books at least mention the energy crisis caused by the oil embargo of 1973 and the Iran-Iraq War in 1979. No worries, however. Textbook authors imply that both crises found immediate solutions. As a result of the 1973 embargo, Triumph of the American Nation tells us, Nixon announced a program to make the United States independent of all foreign countries for its energy requirements by the early 1980s. 10 pages later, in response to gas rationing in 1979, Carter set forth another energy plan, calling for a massive program to develop synthetic fuels. The long-range goal of the plan was to cut importation of oil in half. No mention in 1979 of Nixon's 1973 plan, which had failed so abjectly that our dependence on foreign oil had spiraled upward, not downward. No mention that Congress never even passed most of Carter's 1979 plan, inadequate as it was. Virtually all the textbooks adopt this trouble-free approach. By the end of the Carter administration, the energy crisis had eased off, Land of Promise reassures its readers. Americans were building and buying smaller cars. People gradually began to use less gasoline and conserve energy, echoes the American tradition. If only it were that simple. Between 1950 and 1975, world fuel consumption doubled. Oil and gas consumption tripled, and the use of electricity grew almost sevenfold. If our sources of energy aren't infinite, which seems likely since we live on a finite planet, then at some point we will run up against those shortages. A century ago, farming in America was energy self-sufficient. Livestock provided the fertilizer and tillage power. Farm families did the work of planting and weeding. Wood heated the house. Wind pumped the water. And photosynthesis grew the crops. Today, American farming relies on enormous amounts of oil, not only for tractors and trucks and air conditioning, but also for fertilizers and herbicides. Given these circumstances, most social and natural scientists concluded from the 1973 energy crisis that we cannot blithely maintain our economic growth forever. Anyone having the slightest familiarity with the physics of heat, energy, and matter, wrote Michonne in 1977, will realize that, in terms of historical time, the end of economic growth as we currently experience it cannot be that far off. This is largely because of the awesome power of compound interest. Economic growth at 3%, a conventional standard, means that the economy doubles every quarter century, typically doubling society's use of raw materials, expenditures of energy, and generation of waste. The energy crises of 1973 and 1979 pointed to the difficulty that capitalism, a marvelous system of production, was never designed to accommodate shortage. For demand to exceed supply is supposed to be good for capitalism, leading to increased production and often to lower costs. Oil, however, is not really produced, but extracted. In a way, it's rationed by the oil companies and OPEC from an unknown but finite pool. Thus, the oil companies, which we habitually perceive as competing capitalist producers, might more accurately be viewed as keepers of the commons. America has seen commons problems before. Imagine a colonial New England town in which each household kept a cow. Every morning a family member would take the cow to the common town pasture, where it would join other cows and graze all day under the supervision of a cowherd paid by the town. An affluent family might benefit from buying a second cow. Any excess milk and butter they could sell to cowless sailors and merchants. Expansion of this sort could go on only for a finite period, however, before the common pasture was hopelessly overgrazed. What was in the short-term interest of the individual family was not in the long-term interest of the community. If we compare contemporary oil companies with cow-holding colonial families, we see that new forms of governmental regulations, analogous to the regulated use of the commons, may be necessary to assure there will be a commons, in this case, an oil pool, for our children. The commons issue affects our society in other ways. I write this chapter within sight of Chesapeake Bay, in a year when the crab and oyster harvests are unprecedentedly low. A catch of 20 million bushels in 1892 and 3,500,000 in 1982 fell to just 166,000 bushels in 1992. Fisher folk have responded the way people usually do when their standard of living is imperiled. Work harder. This means redoubling their efforts to take more of the few crabs and oysters still out there. Although this tactic may benefit an individual family, it cannot but wreak disaster on the commons. The problem of the bay is amplified in the oceans. The United Nations is struggling to develop a global system to manage and repropagate the fish that are still left. Since international waters are involved, however, negotiations may not succeed until after many species have been made extinct. Because the economy has become global, the commons now encompasses the entire planet. If we consider that around the world, humans owned 10 times as many cars in 1990 as in 1950, no sane observer would predict that such a proportional increase could or should continue for another 40 years. Quantitatively, the average U.S. citizen consumes the same resources as 10 average world citizens, or 25 residents of India. Our continued economic development coexists in some tension with a corollary of the archetype of progress, the notion that America's cause is the cause of all humankind. Thus, our economic leadership is very different from our political leadership. Politically, we can hope other nations will put in place our forms of democracy and respect for civil liberties. Economically, we can only hope other nations will never achieve our standard of living, for if they did, the earth would become a desert. Economically, we are the bane, not the hope of the world. Since the planet is finite, as we expand our economy, we make it less likely that less developed nations can expand theirs. Almost every day brings new reasons for ecological concern, from deforestation at the equator to ozone holes at the poles. Cancer rates climb, and we don't know why. We have no way even to measure the full extent of human impact on the Earth. The average sperm count in healthy human males around the world has dropped by nearly 50% over the past 50 years. If environmentally caused, this is no laughing matter. For sperm have only to decline in a straight line for another 50 years, and we will have wiped out mankind without even knowing how we did it. We were similarly unaware for years that killing mosquitoes with DDT was wiping out birds of prey around the globe. Our increasing power makes it increasingly possible that humankind will make the planet uninhabitable by accident. All these considerations imply that more of the same economic development and nation-state governance that brought us this far may not guide us to a livable planet in the long run. At some point in the future, perhaps before readers of today's high school textbooks pass their 50th birthdays, industrialized nations, including the United States, may have to move toward steady-state economies in their consumption of energy and raw materials. Getting to zero economic growth involves another form of the problem of the commons, however, for no country wants to be first to achieve a no-growth economy, just as no individual family finds it in its interest to stop with one cow. A new international mechanism may be required, one hard even to envision today. Heilbronner is pessimistic. No substantial voluntary diminution of growth, much less a planned reorganization of society, is today even remotely imaginable. If tomorrow citizens must imagine diminished growth, we can't rest easily, knowing that most high school history courses do nothing whatever to prepare Americans of the future to think imaginatively about the problem. Continued unthinking allegiance to the idea of progress in our textbooks can only be a deterrent, blinding students to the need for change, thus making change that much more difficult. David Donald characterizes the incurable optimism of American history courses as not merely irrelevant, but dangerous. In this sense, our environmental crisis is an educational problem to which American history courses contribute. Edward O. Wilson divides those who write on environmental issues into two camps, environmentalists and exceptionalists. Most scholars and writers, including Wilson, are of the former persuasion. On the other side stand a relative handful of political scientists, economists, and natural scientists, several associated with right-wing think tanks, who have mounted important counter-arguments to the doomsaying environmentalists. Julian Simon, Herman Kahn, and others compare today's world to the world of our ancestors and argue that although modern societies have more power to harm the planet, they also have more power to set the environment right. Hence, modern technology may exempt us from environmental pressures. The exceptionalists point out that recovery time after natural disasters such as earthquakes or man-made disasters such as World War II is much shorter today than in the previous century, owing in part to the ability of our large bureaucratic organizations to mobilize information and coordinate enormous undertakings. Human life expectancy, one measure of the quality of life, continues to lengthen. Herbert London, who titled his book, Why Are They Lying to Our Children?, because he believes that teachers and textbooks overemphasize the perils of economic growth, points out that more food is available today than 20 years ago. Such optimism gives economist Michon faint comfort. From the mere fact that humanity has survived to the present, no hope for the future can be salvaged. The human race can perish only once. In short, we are in a huge debate. If the majority of books and articles and arguments in this chapter seem skewed to favor the environmentalists, perhaps the potential downside risk, if they are right, makes this bias appropriate. But for textbook authors simply to join the chorus of doomsayers without presenting arguments from the exceptionalists would be intellectually negligent. Authors could show trends in the past that suggest we face catastrophe and other trends that suggest solutions. Doing so would encourage students to use evidence from history to reach their own conclusions. History reveals many previously vital societies, from the Mayans and Easter Island to Haiti and the Canaries, that irreparably damaged their ecosystems. Considering the beauty of the land, Christopher Columbus wrote on first seeing Haiti, there must be gain to be got. Columbus and the Spanish transformed the island biologically by introducing diseases, plants, and livestock. The pigs, hunting dogs, cows, and horses propagated quickly, causing tremendous environmental damage. By 1550, the thousands upon thousands of pigs in the Americas had all descended from the 8 pigs that Columbus brought over in 1493. Although these islands had been, since God made the earth, prosperous and full of people lacking nothing they needed, a Spanish settler wrote in 1518 after the Europeans' arrival, they were laid waste, inhabited only by wild animals and birds. Later, sugarcane monoculture replaced gardening in the name of quick profit, thereby impoverishing the soil. More recently, population pressure has caused Haitians and Dominicans to farm the island's steep hillsides, resulting in erosion of the topsoil. Today, this island ecosystem that formerly supported a large population in relative equilibrium is in far worse condition than when Columbus first saw it. This sad story may be a prophecy for the future, now that modern technology has the power to make the entire Earth a Haiti. On the other hand, Julian Simon has pointed out how most short-term predictions of shortages in everything from whale oil in the last century to food in the 1970s to silver in the 1990s have been confuted by new technological developments. Moreover, environmental damage has been undone. Some American rivers that were deemed hopelessly polluted 40 years ago are now fit for fish and human swimmers. Human activity has reforested South Korea. Textbooks might also present these adaptive capacities of modern society. Ironically, textbooks that assure us that everything will come out right in the end don't report any of the reasoning or evidence marshaled by Simon and his ilk. Instead, they exhort students to accept on faith that they need not worry much about where we are going. Their endorsement of progress is as shallow as General Electric's, a company that claims, "Progress is our most important product," but whose ecological irresponsibility earned it a place on Fortune's list of the 10 worst corporate environmental offenders. Not one textbook brings up the whale oil lesson, the Haiti lesson, or any other inference from the past that might bear on the question of progress and the environment. In sum, although this debate may be the most important of our time, no hint of its seriousness seeps into our history textbooks. If textbook authors revised their closing pages to jettison the unthinking devotion to progress. Their final chapters would sit in uneasy dissonance with earlier chapters. Their tone throughout would have to change. From their titles on, American history textbooks are celebratory, and the idea of progress legitimates the celebration. Textbook authors present our nation as getting ever better in all areas, from race relations to transportation. The traditional portrayal of Reconstruction as a period of Yankee usurpation and Negro debauchery fits with the upward curve of progress, for if relations were bad in Reconstruction, perhaps not as bad as in slavery, but surely worse than what came later, then we can imagine that race relations have gradually been getting better. However, the facts about Reconstruction compel us to acknowledge that in many ways race relations in this country have yet to return to the point reached in, say, 1870. In that year, to take a small but symbolic example, A.T. Morgan, a white state senator from Hinds County, Mississippi, married Carrie Highgate, a black woman from New York, and was reelected. Today, this probably couldn't happen, not in Hinds County, Mississippi, or in many counties throughout the United States. Nonetheless, the archetype of progress prompts many white Americans to conclude that black Americans have no legitimate claim on our attention today because the problem of race relations has surely been ameliorated. A.T. Morgan's marriage is hard for us to make sense of because Americans have so internalized the cultural archetype of progress that by now we have a built-in tendency to assume that we are more tolerant, more sophisticated, more, well, progressive than we were in the past. Even a trivial illustration, Abraham Lincoln's beard, can teach us otherwise. In 1860, a clean-shaven Lincoln won the presidency. In 1864, with a beard, he was reelected. Could that happen nowadays? Today, many institutions, from investment banking firms to Brigham Young University, are closed to white males with facial hair. No white president or Supreme Court candidate has ventured even a mustache since Tom Dewey in 1948. Beards may not in themselves be signs of progress, although mine has subtly improved my thinking, but we have reached an arresting state of intolerance when the huge Disney Corporation, founded by a man with a mustache, will not allow any employee to wear one. On a more profound note, consider that Lincoln was also the last American president who was not a member of a Christian denomination while taking office. Americans may not be becoming more tolerant. We may only think we are. Thus, the ideology of progress amounts to a chronological form of ethnocentrism. Not only does the siren song of progress lull us into thinking that everything now is more advanced, it also tempts us to conclude that societies long ago were more primitive than they may have been. Progress underlay the various unilinear evolutionary schemes into which our society used to classify peoples and cultures. Savagery, barbarism, civilization, for example, or gathering, hunting, horticultural, agricultural, industrial. Under the influence of these schemes, scholars completely misconceived primitive humans as living lives that, as Hobbes put it, were nasty, brutish, and short. Only higher cultures were conceived of as having sufficient leisure to develop art, literature, or religion. Anthropologists have long known better. Despite the theories traditionally taught in high school social studies, pointed out anthropologist Peter Farb, the truth is, the more primitive the society, the more leisured its way of life. Thus, primitive cultures were hardly nasty. As to brutish, we might recall the comparison of the peaceful Arawaks on Haiti and the Spanish conquistadors who subdued them. Short is also problematic. Before encountering the diseases brought by Europeans and Africans, many people in Australia, the Pacific Islands, and the Americas probably enjoyed remarkable longevity, particularly when compared with European and African city dwellers. They live a long life and rarely fall sick, observed Giovanni da Verrazzano, after whom the Verrazzano Narrows and Bridge in New York City are named. The Indians be of lusty and healthful bodies, not experimentally knowing the catalog.